Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we left off last time in chapter 4 on adulthood, which is July and August. And we will start with the topic, tall perennials. In the way that I crave the botanical extravagance of outside leaves, I have a strong attraction for plants that attain a great height in a season. Though early on I would not have known what to do with a 6 to 8 foot perennial, today I can think of many uses. To back a perennial border, to punctuate the corners of a bed or the start of a path, the way a column might, to simply break up the monotony of a bed of so many lumpy 2 and 3 foot shapes with a giant exclamation point, or to create a seasonal living wall or screen. A big bed I created of towering perennials is positioned perfectly to block the view of my compost heap and an extra vegetable growing patch where asparagus and raspberries are tucked away. While all around them are losing their heads, the tallest perennials are just coming into their own. No need for deadheads. These big boys are fresh-looking, a striking counterpoint to tattered earlier stars. The ones I have a special affection for include some American natives that attract bees and butterflies. Later in the year, birds investigate the seed heads too. My first tall perennial was Joe Pye Weed, Eutrochium purpureum, often still referred to as Eupotorium, which I had seen growing wild in moist wild spots and then at garden centers too. Soon came Rudbeckia, a herbstone, the autumn sun cornflower. Though to be a hybrid of R. nitida and R. racilinita, it rises to 7 feet with a wonderful linear swaying quality. Then R. submentosa, Henry Eilers, at maybe 5 feet with strangely quilled yellow rays. Veronia novaboracensis, the New York ironweed, is another 7-footer, with magenta purple fall flowers. The tallest herbaceous plant I grow, an Asian import, joins them in that big camouflage bed. Miscanthus giganteus, which soars to 10 feet and in years with lots of rain tries to reach a dozen. In a shadier location in July, I enjoy my big stand of black cohosh or bugbane, an eastern native plant whose creamy candelabras of bottle brush flowers can top 8 feet and emit a distinctive sweet scent, calling in all manner of interested insects. Even its seed heads are charming, and I leave them standing into latest fall. I have complained about plants I've had forever that I wish would simply go away. A counterpoint, Thalictrum Rochebrunianum, I hope I said that right, a towering meadow rue, has been here most of more than 20 years, too, and I sincerely hope it never departs. This old friend is a Japanese native. There are American species, such as the charming little rue anemone, T. thalictroides, with white blooms in spring, hugging the woodland floor. My summertime companion, though, produces lavish lavender 3-foot-wide sprays of tiny flowers, each with showy yellow stamens on 10-foot stems painted appropriately purple and dressed up with delicate blue-green foliage reminiscent of columbine. No wonder, since the two are cousins in the Ranunculaceae, or buttercup family, as are Delphinium, Clematis, and Aconitum. A note about the height of my stalwart giant. All the references say 6 or 7 feet when blooming, but I take a tape measure into the garden, and 10 feet it is. Our next topic is Houtuninia and other weeds I planted. I have killed many plants, most of them unintentionally, and many of them with the regret. So why can't I kill Houtuninia cordata, the so-called chameleon plant, despite years of trying? I bought it more than 20 years ago for the showiness of its then variegated red, green, and yellow foliage, and its touted use as a ground cover in moist shade, even suited to plunging right in a pot in water, apparently. Certain that I had acquired a treasure, I was upset when it didn't return from underground after its first winter. Dead, I reported in my newspaper garden column at the time, gone. It was another year before the chameleon turned on me again and resurfaced. Its resurrection was cause for celebration. Not dead, not gone. I guess you know the rest of the story if you've ever grown an invasive disguised as an ornamental. It behaved for a moment or two, acting thoroughly charming, then proceeded to get thuggish, and also to lose its variegation, reverting to the stronger-willed green version. Not on your life, I said, as it overran pulmonaria and golden seal and trilliums. Oh, no, you don't. Out came the spading fork, and after the seeming bulk was sent to the trash, out came the sheets of heavy plastic, as I tried to bake the remainder to death all summer, called solarizing. At first, I used black plastic, but things get even hotter under clear, I read, so that was next. By springtime, it was not gone. A year later, by then 2 years beneath plastic, still not gone. But it had spread farther sideways underground. Even if I wanted to use the herbicide glyphosate to stop it, friends reported that it didn't work on theirs, and it was insidiously tangled in plants I'd harm. I tried lifting the plastic and sowing grass seed instead, and mowing for a few seasons to no effect, and then resorted back to the plastic, repeatedly digging out every emerging shoot and root. mowing for a decade or so will probably kill whatever resprouts, I figured, right? Or not? And so I ask again, why won't this plant die? Ditto gooseneck loosestrife, which is pretty enough and nice in arrangements, but all I really want to say about it, too, is go away. Add the ground cover called Yellow Archangel to the depressing list of weeds I planted and will never be rid of. Though with that one, I actually think digging for multiple years just might do it, and I recently embarked on that campaign. Take this as commiseration, since I suspect you have your own such burdens. Take it also as a warning to all of us who shop for plants, since all of my invasive ornamentals are still for sale. These days, every purchase I consider is preceded with a little online research about its reputation for bad behavior in my region, an essential cautionary step. And we've come to the end of that chapter, so we're going to start the next chapter, which is Senescence, which is September and October. And we start with, write-up from her. And this one is titled, Nothing Lasts. I have yet to grow a cherry tree, but by my own way of thinking, that is just some pesky detail I cannot let weigh me down. In the spirit of how it's really the spirit of a thing that counts, I nevertheless observe Sakura Matsuri, the Cherry Blossom Festival, pretty much weekly from late April through November, as I have for years. Yes, it is a festival that traditionally marks the coming of spring, or in bigger picture terms, of renewal, in the form of the prunus blooms. But Sakura Matsuri is more than an oh-what-pretty-flower celebration, most poignantly reminding us to pay particular attention to the fact of the ephemeral nature of all living things. Cherry blossoms are beautiful, but fleeting. What might for a moment be full blooms is suddenly pink and white snow. Nothing lasts. Need I say more to a bunch of gardeners? Not winter, nor spring, not the flower, nor its pollinators, not us. However tight we hold, we cannot stop the petals from shattering. I repeat, nothing lasts. All these years of growing things has instilled a reverence for the winding downside, and so my own derivative tradition is to mark each major passing in the garden, each fallen hero, and not just each arriving bloom. In April, it was the magnolia by the kitchen window who could not hold on one moment longer. In June, the giant rhododendron out back said farewell for at least another year. As if to make its point, it's dropped its lavender flowers in the garden pool beneath, creating a serendipitous color play with the mid-ribs of the Japanese painted ferns at the water's edge. Now around me, it is so many, many leaves, too many for one girl and her rake, and how can it be another autumn so soon? Nothing lasts, which makes it all the more precious, no? Watching this over and again through so many seasons, how is it that I still defer or delay even a moment of a single day? And yet, so far at least, there are bulbs once again not ordered, as if I have an infinite number of falls ahead to plant them in the hopes of a spring show. And frankly, much bigger, lifeless items have been pushed back over and again, too. What am I waiting for? A friend was talking just yesterday about a corollary, about things she had been saving for some special occasion, that perfume her father gave her that she never dares wear, as if she'd be wasting it. The favorite, that unworn jeans. It brought up memories that trace, as many things do, to Grandma Marion, my mother's mother, the first gardener I ever knew. Grandma always gave us treats, things like homesick pills, as she called the red and white swirled peppermints that she's dispensed to me and her namesake, my sister, when our parents were away. Or the madcap gumdrop faces on our scoops of ice cream and preposterous home-baked birthday cakes, one shaped like a lamb and flocked in shredded baker's coconut. There were beautiful big cookies from Schraff's, shaped like ducks and chicks, colorfully frosted and carefully wrapped in clear cellophane so you could keep an eye on them. My cowgirl of a baby sister tore open and beheaded her pastry poultry before we could even say thank you, but not me. I kept a big tin box on the floor of my closet, and each new adoptee would be gently added to my secret Noah's Ark. I never ate a single cookie. Everything stayed just so, and just in case, just like my friend, Miss Save It for a Rainy Day, and her perfume. I never told her, but if I had, Grandma would have understood. She repeated the same line every Sunday at dinner. I'm going to the old folks' home soon, a widow, she hinted in her way at financial insecurity and fear. It turned out that Grandma had her own treasure chest on her closet floor, a small safe my mother came upon when choosing a dress for her mother to be buried in. Inside was a stack of bank books that wouldn't have qualified Grandma as rich, but could have kept her in her beloved house and garden nearby, the one she had to sell when it's into a gardenless apartment she dispatched herself. The bank books represented the house proceeds and then some. The way I tally things, Grandma gave up 10 more seasons in her garden for the false security of a lockbox and some bank books. I hope I can resist such emotionally costly parsimony and just stay here and watch the succession of every passing until it's my turn. My friend is right. We need to light the candles, drink the too-good-to-drink gift wine, eat those damn animal cookies already. Well, maybe the latter are many decades past their sell-by date. We need to go ahead, to stop pretending that deferring will make the perishable persistent or the now forever. No amount of magical thinking can make it otherwise. Nothing lasts. The garden, the most ephemeral of art forms and rigorous of spiritual practices, is a constant reminder of why we mustn't wait. Hurry, limited engagement only. Act now. It's a vivid, perishable embodiment of how things live and die. Nothing lasts. I say it all the time when I lecture the garden groups, the cry of carpe diem. Celebrate the passings, I say out loud too. Not just the full bloom on the crab apples, but the pink puddle of fallen petals beneath them. Stop chasing just the peak moments. I invoke perfection with everything just so is an illusion. And here comes an angry gust of wind or a pounding rain or ice storm to prove my point. Savor every drop, not just the obvious. Yes, enough. Enjoy the big, insistent flowers, but don't overlook the little things, the buds, the bugs, the bark. Apparently, I need to take a seat in the audience for one of my upcoming events and really listen. Leaves fall. A potted Japanese maple made quite a display this week on the paving stones around it, and I am in no hurry whatsoever to rake things up. If I do adopt a cherry, perhaps it will be Prunus subhirtella, autumn nalis, which is, if happy with its location and the conditions in a given year, will flower not just in the spring, but again in fall. Two more opportunities for a Sakura Matsuri, and with the correct genus, both times even. And we'll go to our first topic for this chapter, and it's fall leaves and pink mums. We should all age so gracefully, assuming a glowing honey gold stage like the last breath of the most generous ferns and hostas in one of their finest moments, poised just before they fade in a glorious, violently colored decline to sleep a while until the cycle begins again. The growing season may come alive in earliest spring in colors suited to a baby's layette, but when the end is near, the well-planted garden goes out in a blaze of glory. I like this bodier hot end of things. Don't clean up too soon. As much as I love fall, it would be easier for me to list plants I've purchased that don't look good than those that do. Maples in general are hot stuff, whether the giant native red and sugar maples at my boundaries or the purchased Japanese maples, particularly Acer pseudoxybuldeanum, a Korean species about 15 to 20 feet high and wide and among the hardiest of and most fiery. Masses of fruit everywhere are extra ornamental until the cedar waxwings and robins have at it. Sumacs and blueberries, spice bush and bottle bush, buckeye all contribute, and panicle hydrangeas are a crazy mix of hot sauce and cotton candy, a twist on the usual fall palate, which gives me another idea. With all this flaming stuff, I wonder each fall, while garden centers sell chrysanthemums that match the foliar display, flowers in rusty or maroon or gold tones, I also wonder why we have such a passion for those pinched into submission pots of two perfect mums, anyhow. Like some kind of containerized throwback to Victorian carpet bedding, but apparently that's just me. May I suggest pink mums instead, and specifically perennial ones? You won't toss these on the compost, but will instead divide them in spring, and yes, some pinching along the way will be required to make them manageable size and not too leggy at bloom time. If you are feeling very brave, look for Will's Wonderful, with small, extra hot pink flowers with oversized gold centers. More discreet would be the larger pale pink choice of Sheffield pink. A gardener wanting extra good results must bone up on the following perennials and bulbs or bulb-like plants at the very minimum: toad lily, yellow bells, asters, ironweed, autumn crocus, bush clover, hybrid Japanese anemones, goldenrod, and oh, if only I had planted dahlias too in spring, specifically in every shade of pink. And our next topic is, repeat after me. Early fall allows another opportunity for divisions and transplanting, and so I have a little story to tell. It was my first really rare plant, a plant so unusual that it wasn't even in the commercial nursery industry at the time, and still isn't widely sold. I had scored it at a botanical garden auction and was very impressed with myself, as if this possession made me someone special. I had Hylomicone hybris. Each April, at its bloom time, I would go out to see my Hylomicone japonicum, which I regarded more like a shrine than a plant, really, patting myself on the back all the while. Then, one cold, wet spring day, there was a hole where my plant had been, and a very tall man in a yellow rain suit the color of its flowers was standing beside the hole, carving up the extracted plant with his pocket knife as if he were eating an apple. The man was my cousin, my friend Charles, and I wanted to kill him. Screaming, door slamming, and worse ensued. "You are so selfish with this plant. You don't even share it with yourself," Charles said, still shouting, and then proceeding to go back outside and begin to deposit little divisions of Hylomicone, an Asian ephemeral in the poppy family. It put in potentially drift-like patterns around a few spots. "You love this plant," he pointed out, saying we should make it a signature of the garden, not just one lovely dot. And, of course, we've come to the end of our program, today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.